Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. The show tapes live some weeks on Thursdays at 5 p.m. Pacific Time. Check my Twitter feed, ANNZAC, for more. Enjoy the show. Everybody, welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Burgee. Jacob Chapman is here.
Hey, guys.
And joining us over Skype, it's a friend of the show, Dylan Keelman. You know him on Twitter as Hazukari. Dylan, thanks for coming by the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Once more. And also joining us again, he's been on the show a lot. He works at Discotech. And full disclaimer, he worked on the Blu-rays, the English language Blu-rays for the show that we're about to talk about. Brady Hartle. Brady, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. Yes, I was the producer on the Blu-ray, but... Because I made myself the producer on the Blu-ray because I love the show so much, honestly.
Right, yeah. Well, that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, is because, like, that whole thing was, like, a real labor of love for you, and you obviously give a deep shit about Kyosuke Giga, so it's good to have you on the show. We watched your Blu-rays. That's how we watched the program. Jacob, why don't you describe the show, Kyosuke Giga, like, where it came from, when it aired, all that stuff.
In brief, Kyosuke Giga has sort of a unique production history for an otaku, for a TV anime. Originally, it was a thing conceived by sort of the brain trust at Toei for their like little girls' children's programming, so stuff like Ojimajo, Doremi, and all the Precures and stuff like that. There's sort of like a team that both animates and writes a lot of that stuff. And it's this, you could consider it like the Clamp of magical girl shows at Toei or something. And somehow this came about. They wanted to do this independent project. I don't know if it was because Toei wanted to get into late night anime, or if it was because somebody in the group had an idea, whether it was Rie Matsumoto, the eventual director and like predominant voice of the show, or somebody else in that group. But a series of animated shorts was produced to put up on Nico Nico Douga that were like, you know, Kyosuke Giga, and it's like 5 minutes of madness, like Kyoto themed Alice in Wonderland shenanigans. And those became sort of, like, passed around enough that they produced more and more over the years, and eventually sort of, like, decided to turn it into a TV show and just run it as a late-night anime.
Go ahead.
No, that's kind of, if you have more information, that's kind of the best I got.
Yeah, so. I was going to say that, interject about the Pretty Cure stuff, that Rei Matsumoto, the director of it, she also directed the Hardcatch Pretty Cure movie.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's a team of Precure. It's like a Precure gang. It's like a roving gang of Precure people that really love working together, and they make stuff together.
Mm-hmm. The Precure posse.
Yeah, yes. They have a posse. Yeah, yeah. It's pretty cool. I like that. Mm-hmm. I think that's cool.
I think it's a little weirder than that too, because it's like they released that 6 minute like preview of it, which is completely different than like the show became.
Yeah, it evolved
then I think
every
that like
iteration.
30-minute preview came out, and then a year later the 5-minute episodes came out. Then like a year after that the series came out, and it's like really sort of a like all I can guess is that it took them a while to get funding for the final thing after it was popular as like a short, the ONAs.
Yeah, well, it's not really something that Toei normally does, so it's also kind of a, well, you know, were they, like, testing the waters? Was it, like, an evolution process of let's make an otaku show? You know, what was it exactly? So, who knows? But that's the only information that I got. And so that's kind of how the show came about, in short.
Right. And so the television show as it exists, like, the thing you kind of need to watch is the 10-episode TV show. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say you need to see anything other than that.
Yeah, if you're curious.
Unless you're curious to see sort of what came before and all that. But I would argue you kind of only need to see those 10 episodes of the TV show. Mm-hmm. At least that's what I got the most out of. Then there's, like, this weird episode zero at the beginning.
Right.
That's sort of a blown-out, like, version of
it's
the
It's like a pitch
ONA.
Movie.
It's like, yeah. What?
Which has stuff in it that the rest of it doesn't have in it. But of the ONAs, there's only really one ONA that has anything that's completely different than the TV series.
I may not have watched that one. What was that?
It's where they go over the train system, where they're talking about how the citizens of Kyoto get rid of their unused items. In the ONA version, it's a completely different story almost. It's set as one of Yase Doji's little minions has a camera, and she's interviewing all the characters sort of off the cuff. So she talks to, like, Shoko and obviously Kodo and all the main characters, and it's sort of interesting. But they, when they expanded that story for the TV series, they kept elements of it, like Yase and her cup and everything. But, like, the little short is almost completely different from the TV episode. But the rest of those episodes pretty much exist verbatim in the TV series. Some of the relationships are a little changed, but it's mostly they change a little bit of the dialogue. But yeah, the ONA is the TV series is where it is a fully cohesive thing, really.
Kind of like, even though episode zero is also different from what follows. Episode zero plays like, so it was aired first. It plays like a proof of concept.
Yeah.
It it plays like an overview of, like, basically it's the first half of the show condensed and heightened and a little different in some of the, most of the stuff is the same, but some of it's very different. My favorite difference is that in episode zero, when they are reunited with Lady Koto, who is an important figure in the story, she kisses our protagonist right on the mouth. Just tongue and all. And it's quite shocking because here's the thing. All the stuff in episode zero, you don't know what the story is. You're getting this glut of imagery where you kind of piece together, oh, this is like a super condensed version of the first half of the story. It's like an in media res, like, teaser for what's going to happen. And which is, you know, an interesting way to start. I don't know that I can argue it's better or worse that you should skip it or shouldn't. I think it's just sort of up to your own discretion. But, like, I do think there's pros to watching it before the rest of the show. But there's also obvious cons.
That specific scene in the ONA version of that episode, at the very end, they cut out a part where Kodo is like, man, she kissed me. Like, and she's surprised and... and they cut that out, and like I think they tried to meter the TV version of it, but even still, there's stuff in that TV version that it doesn't make any sense compared to the TV show, because like at the very beginning, Shoko is like giving me back the hammer, and you learn the hammer has nothing to do with her in the actual show.
Yeah, it's like they're piecing together what the ultimate story is going to be, and even that.
Sorry.
Hello.
About that.
Hello.
10 pizzas, please.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I do remember watching the episode zero, I think like a full year before the TV series came out. Our club sampled it, and a lot of people in the club were just like, we have no idea what the hell is going on in this, but it's just cool to look at, so let's just enjoy it for the nice eye candy.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. That change specifically jumps out to me because it is... It's obviously a result of... It's Kyosuke Giga, more than almost any other late-night anime, you can see the evolution of how the story was honed down into a thing that is cohesive, and they, like, tossed out the ideas that didn't work so good and kept the ones that were stronger, because that even extends to this thing that was aired before the proper TV series that is very much part of it, which is... So initially, you know, Kodo reunites with literally her biological mother, and her mother kisses her on the mouth, tongue and all, and which is a little off-putting, but the reason behind it isn't really sexual. It's not like for fan service for like yucks. The reason behind it is sort of that old Japanese folkloric thing of yokai and other Japanese spirits and stuff like that have difficulty telling the difference between humans, especially if they're related. This is a big thing in Natsume's Book of Friends. That's a big ongoing issue. That's almost the entire premise, is that everybody keeps mistaking this boy for his grandmother. You know, obviously they don't... they don't even distinguish gender and stuff like that. So Kodo kissing her on the mouth is supposed to be... She thought that was her husband. Initially, she mistakes her daughter for her husband, because that's just kind of how yokai sort of... The passage of time and stuff like that is a little difficult for them. It doesn't work the same as people. And it's funny, and it's good for a laugh, but I think they realized when writing the TV show that all this family stuff is kind of tender and the emotions are kind of sensitive, and that they can't break the tone too much with stuff like that, even though it might be funny or it might be, like, you know, shocking and get people to watch. Like, in the TV show proper, when they're reunited, this doesn't happen. There's nothing remotely, like, they she brings up one, she has a line that says, "I almost thought you were your father, you were your father at first," and that's it. But they take out the kiss, and so it's like you're watching somebody revise the story and get more like, "Oh, maybe not this. Oh, this kind of breaks the tone." You know, kind of going from the ONAs to episode zero to the show itself.
Yeah, there's I 100% agree. There's, I mean, if you look at the 6-minute pilot too, like there's. The relationship with between the two Kotos, I mean, and that even seems different. And it's like she's using Mama Koto as like sort of like a Fate Stay Night servant almost. And she's fighting Inari with Koto in that little pilot. And that's completely different. That pilot has like characters in it that aren't even in the final show. And you can see it's sort of interesting to look at this show because since there's like 3 or 4 different versions of it, you can see where like the creative process of how like it went from one thing to another thing to another thing.
Yeah. In fact, yeah. Like that, which kind of goes in keeping with the entire show as this sort of the way I saw that Kyosugeki was just sort of this extremely ambitious explosion of like an artist trying very, very hard to make sure everybody knows they've planted their flag in the ground. Like, it, this is like, arrived. Yeah, I have arrived. Here is my thing. I have showed up. Witness it. That's kind of what it felt like.
Yeah, it's extremely enthusiastic and a little bit...
rough around the edges, real sloppy kind of, and like, yeah. Yeah, and,
My entire time watching it, I just kept on thinking it's very similar to, like, Fooly Cooly in presentation style.
Yeah, I would say so. I think Fooly Cooly is tighter scripted, but yeah.
I mean, like, I meant visual wise, not sure. Storytelling.
Yeah.
Matsumoto's. It's interesting. People like always. Rie Matsumoto is the director of this, and it's a person we're going to be talking about a lot during the podcast because obviously she wrote a lot of it too. Because it's just you can kind of tell what she wrote, especially after seeing Blood Blockade Battlefront, which was her next project, and seeing the anime like original baby. Content, which is like 100% you wrote this because it's just like Kyosugeki. And that's my train of thought. Anyway, so I think that when she produced this, it is like she's sort of wadding all of her ideas into this show and pushing as hard as she can with as many different ideas as she can. Not to mention whatever other ideas came from Toei and the staff. So it feels a little overstuffed in terms of, like, if this is the only thing I got, or if this is the first thing I got and I have to make a strong impression, I'm going to make a strong fucking impression, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, Blood Blockade Battlefront's kind of the same way also, where it's just a lot's happening all at once, like, it kind of doesn't hold your hand storytelling-wise. It's like, okay, we're going to go 1,000,000 miles a minute, and if you don't pay attention to any of this stuff, well, you're lost, too bad. Mm-hmm. Which I kind of like about this show, though.
Oh, that's what I was going to say. I was like, what was it? Oh, right, her animation style. It's hard. People have trouble, like, her animation style looks a little like Gainax. It looks a little like Studio Wit sometimes. But it's, like, it's hard to describe. I think the thing that makes it different to me from Gainax, I think the closest comparison is Gainax or is a Fooly Cooly. The thing that makes it different to me is that it's a little more sharp-edged. Like, I think of Gainax, I think of the same kind of flat and jumpy and like cartoonish animation, but it has softer curves to it. And I feel like with Rie Matsumoto, you're getting a lot more sharp edges and sharp movements and sort of I don't know, like a spiky look. However, the actual like the way that her character animation and the action and stuff like that works, it's not like. It doesn't look harsh. It's fluffy. So you have basically sort of a spiky thing with a fluffy center. And it's like describing animation is difficult. So
yeah, it's tough. I think that's a really good try, though. You gave it a good shot.
Right. So you kind of want to cuddle these characters, but they don't look like they're not like blobular or squishy or stuff like that. Like a Masaki Yuasa thing where it's like, where it looks huggable per se. They look kind of sharp and off-putting and like really over superpowered and stuff like that, like they blow up a city or something like that, but they also look really like sweet and childlike and cuddly, so it's kind of a weird blend.
Right. So I agree with that. I was a little again like with a lot of things with Kyosugeki, it was like, well, reach exceeding grasp, like there's a lot of cool aesthetics on display. The actual animation itself was only good in moments, really. Like, for most of the time, for me, the animation was kind of not great. Lot of wide shots, a lot of real sloppy drawing in there. But, like, you know, you kind of expect that a little bit. We should probably move on to the story, I think. Like, get into the story a little bit, considering how complicated it is. Well, I feel like the way to structure this discussion is to just go through the story bit by bit.
In pieces.
And there's kind of a first half and a second half. And, Jacob, I've assigned you the task of describing the story of this of this thing. So I guess do the best you can on, like, the first two episodes or so.
Right. So the very, very beginning. So the reason Kiyosuke is a bit of a challenge is, as I describe this, it may sound a little bit like you're hearing a story from a crazy person, but it is... this is the plot of Kiyosuke, which is a long time ago. There was an old priest, not an old priest, but... I mean, kind of, but a middle-aged priest named Myoe, who lived in the mountains outside of Kyoto, and everything that he drew came to life. And one day he drew a rabbit, or actually he drew a rabbit very long ago because it was like the patron god of Kyoto, and he was like making a collage of Kyoto beneath him. And he drew this big collage, and he over it, just for kicks and giggles, he drew the deity, which is a rabbit, over the tower. And she came to life, and she found that she was falling in love with the priest. She sort of pled to a bodhisattva, which is, you know, like an incarnation of the Buddha, to give her a human body so that she could express her feelings for him. And so, she came to life as a person, and then she hung out with the priest for a while, and they were like, okay, so, we can't go back down into the city because the Onmyoji and stuff like that will kill you because you're a literal monster come to life, but... We'll hang out here and we'll stay away from the humans and we'll build a life for each other out here. Over the course of time, they had three children, not biologically, but like he doodled some children and then he adopted one, a normal human boy and two weird monsters that he drew. And but this was enough for the Onmyoji to where they said, okay, we're gonna have to step in and if you don't get rid of these abominations, we're gonna have to have a talk. And so he said, okay, fine. So he literally walked into the giant drawing of Kyoto that he made and took his family with him, and they lived there. And that is the very beginning of the story. So they are now living in the cool world, which is...
It's a pretty cool...
It's cool world Kyoto.
World.
And so it's Kyoto only cartoonified, where nothing
can be destroyed.
Do what?
And nothing can be destroyed.
Yes, nothing can be destroyed or kind of created, but not really. Things don't tend to change. So he and his wife and his lady and his three children are living in this Kyoto where, like, crazy cartoony stuff happens, stuff blows up or whatever, but it all reforms back afterwards, so it's totally fine. It's the status quo remains quo. And until there comes a day where the rabbits... promise with the bodhisattva has to be fulfilled, which is that this human body is only temporary and she has to go. And so she and her husband come up with a plan that, like, to basically make the most of the time she has left. And in order to do this, they have to leave the kids behind because they can't take them with them back to the human world or they'll be in trouble. So they have to leave them in cool world Kyoto. So they leave. And the rest of the story is them getting older and older. I don't know if the kids that he drew become older naturally, or if they just do that, if they just revise their appearances manually over time. But obviously, the human boy that he adopted ages normally-ish, slower than average, but he still like gets into his mid-20s, and they're waiting for their father to come back. And suddenly there's an explosion in the sky over the train station, you know, where usually people come in and out of the cool world if they do, which is very rare. And somebody appears, but it's not his dad. It's a little girl, about 14 or so, named Kodo, which is his mother's name. And she's brought with her a giant hammer, and she said that she came here in search of the rabbit, which is obviously sort of an Alice in Wonderland reference. Only it's not a white rabbit, it's a black rabbit. And so the rest of the story is them trying to figure out how she is related to their parents and what they can do with her, and just trying to control her because she's sort of a rambunctious. She's the most cartoony character in you know the cartoon world is kind of not as cartoony as this normal human who enters it. And
she's also the only person that can destroy anything in the world as well.
She brings with her a giant hammer that allowed her to get into the world, and it is. When it breaks things, they don't go back to normal. So, yeah.
So, what was your first... Because, like, you tried to watch this show a while ago and only got about halfway through it, right? So, what was it about the first half of the show that initially, you know, repelled you?
Well, it isn't, so this isn't a good comparison, because this character is, in fact, wrong in the movie, and sort of half, it's partially the villain, but there's a line in Amadeus where the king says to Mozart, "There are simply too many notes, Herr Mozart," and that was kind of my reaction. It's like, there's too many notes in this symphony. It was too many ideas for me to really keep track of. And so while I was enjoying it as an intellectual exercise, I, at the time, had a lot on my plate in terms of a bunch of stuff to write and work on and stuff like that. And so I was assigning mental energy to understanding and connecting with this show that I couldn't expend at the time. And so while I was enjoying it, nothing about it put me off. Like, I had to stop about halfway through, because it was like, this is a big time investment. So I'm gonna, you know, it's not a passive watch in the background show. It is
no.
Full attention.
No. Yeah. Like, I think I've watched it 8 times and there's still stuff I don't understand about it.
Yeah, I was gonna say, also, it's one of those shows that's hard, I think, to watch, like, week to week.
Oh, you know, that's what I was gonna ask, is if it was a different experience week to week versus all at once. Because we pretty much watched it all in 2 sittings, 3 sittings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's why I watched it in, like, 2 sittings. Because I got only 3 episodes in when it was simulcasting before I gave up.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you gave up.
Well, I had a lot on my plate also, just with work and stuff like that. And I only had time for, like, 2 shows. So it was Kill la Kill and something else during that season.
Right. And Kyosuke Giga was challenging. Mm-hmm. And, like, you have to make a decision as to whether or not you're going to sit there and watch that show and, like, spend the mental energy it takes. And, like, I feel like that's actually kind of an important message to tell people when you're approaching shows like this. Man, it's okay if it strikes you as too fucking much.
Yeah, too
you're
much.
Not, like, an idiot because you didn't cotton to it, or you didn't particularly like that kind of storytelling. Like, it's really dense. Mm-hmm. It's actively kind of hard to get into. Like, and it's confusing. It requires your full attention. So, like, if you had trouble getting into this or shows like it, like, don't feel bad about that. Mm-hmm. Like, even the people that you consider maybe to be snobs or whatever have, like, a lot of trouble sometimes getting into shows like that. Like, everybody has a tough time with material that's challenging like that, you know?
I'll definitely say it's one of the most obtuse television anime, I think, in, like, the past 5 years. And, I mean, it's my favorite show of the decade, but It's a lot to chew on, definitely.
So eventually it became your favorite show of this yet-to-be-completed decade.
Yeah, I still would put it as my favorite. I didn't really feel that way until I watched it a second time, and I was like, wow, this is really something really special.
Right.
I would propose that compared to other hoity-toity shows, like any given, like, Ikuhara show or I say we, but I'm just speaking for myself, like any given Ikuhara show or Wolf's Rain or something like that. I think one of the things that makes Kyosuke Giga more difficult, because it's not more difficult in thematic subject matter. When we watched it this time, like, I got it. I don't. There's probably a lot of little things that I missed, but overall, I definitely got what was going on and thematically and everything that was happening. It's not, like, more difficult than all those other shows. The difference is that it's super duper based in Japanese folklore and Buddhism, which I am
not as
familiar with. As I am, like, something like the subject matter of an Ikuhara show, which is, like, you know, like, fairy tales or like, Japanese movies from the 50s or something like that that's a little closer, or the Lost Generation stuff. Like, it's more familiar to me than, like, the Choji Giga, which is what the show's name is based off of. So Kyosuke Giga means, because this is not really going to come up at any other point, it's like Kyoto, but it's, like, fake Kyoto, so it's Kyoso, and then Giga, Ogiga, comes from Choji Giga, which is, like, the first manga, kind of. It's not really manga. It's like an old scroll that you read across, and it tells a story. And it's, like, considered, like, the closest you get to illustrated storytelling's origin in Japan. And it was all cartoon animals. Which is why there's a lot of... the rabbit, most prominently, which is kind of where that comes from. So, yeah. I just prefer to call it Kyoto Cool World, because that kind of, you know.
So that you've described the basic premise, and, like, it takes a little bit for you to really get your head around even just that much of it. Mm-hmm. And, like, I found as the show went on in the first half, I found myself to be so, like, we watched that episode zero thing first. Mm-hmm. And that kind of spoils most of the show, not all of it, but a lot of it. It spoils the first full half or so of the show, and I felt like I was kind of piecing it together. But what I had found is that the plot that you saw in episode zero was pretty much the plot, and everything else was padding. It was just put in there to get to full episode lengths on all of these times. At least to me, it felt like that a lot of time. It developed the characters a bit, but a lot of it was just kind of dicking around. And it's, you know, not paced particularly quickly or anything like that. And I was a little surprised in the first half that this particular show had received so much high praise, because while I appreciated the aesthetic and what they were going for in this, let's take Alice in Wonderland and put it in a blender with like a bunch of different religions and like map Buddhist principles into to make sense of the nonsense in Alice in Wonderland. Like, it's kind of what the show does a little bit. Like, that's really super complex, but what I was seeing was kind of like, well, but what, you know, it, the show did honestly not grab me until about episode six or seven. There was a major character reveal for the main character that suddenly I was like, oh, this is all going to go somewhere, hopefully, and mean something. But it did feel like scratching a little bit through the sand to find, like, there's so much sand, and it's gorgeous, but I'm not sure what to do with all of it. You know what I'm saying? Like, and so once I found once I found something in there to kind of hang on to, then it got me. Then I felt like I really appreciated it. Uh-huh. But not until the second half. And so, like, it doesn't surprise me that a lot of you bailed on it in the first half, if not because it was so complicated, but also because, like, I do feel like that material's a little weaker than the second half.
Yeah, it gets better as it goes. Like, that is the nicest thing. Like, some of the most disappointing anime, the stuff you really forget about, gets weaker as it goes. Like, it'll start real strong, and then it's like, oh, they don't know how to conclude this. Kyosuke Go only gets stronger as it goes.
Yeah, that's for sure.
With the exception of episode 8, which is obviously a get this to 10 episodes, like a filler thing. Like, you know, but we'll talk about that later, I guess. But, like, with the exception of that stumbling point, the show only gets stronger as it goes, and so that's a good thing to have. I think the anime that people really remember and stuff like that, it improves as it goes.
So one of the questions I have is, in the early part of the show, in the first half of the show, which characters did you find yourself most compelled by and most interested in, and which characters did you want to see the story told through? Dylan, why don't we start with you?
For me, it's probably at the beginning, it was probably always Mioe, was always the character I was always interested in, the kid, because, I mean, he is probably the most compelling of all the stories of the three siblings, I feel. Because originally you think that, oh, he's just the son of, the original Mioe. It's just like, you know, he has kind of like this, upheaval from his father, but then you realize, oh, he's an orphan, who always wanted to die, and he was bestowed immortality by his father, and it's just like, I'm trying to find the words for it. It's kind of like a tragedy in some ways, how his character is depicted, and I'm a sucker for family tragedy type things, so that's why I always found him very compelling, if that makes sense.
Sure. No, that, I mean, the show is about family first and foremost. Mm-hmm. But above all else, that's what it's about. So if that's what you're connecting with, that feels like that's what they're going for.
I also say that, so that it's about like family, but that family isn't necessarily blood, but the people you make your family.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Which is a common theme. Like, you see that in a lot, especially a lot of Japanese things. That's common. Nakama, right? The word you can't translate.
Also, the relationship between Mioe and Inari is very much like kind of a Shinji Gendo relationship in some ways, which I'm always a sucker for relationships like that in storytelling.
Right. The old Shinji Gendo, as they call it.
Although, interestingly, they frame another character as Gendo in the most, in episode 8, the most unnecessary segments.
Which made me feel like that was just a throwaway visual reference.
They were trying to pound the conflict out with extra fake conflicts, basically. And there's a fake conflict involving a fake Nerve that they frame exactly like Nerve, and a fake Gendo that they frame exactly like Gendo.
But who thematically have nothing to do.
No, they're just like, nope, sorry, actually, this is not about them at all. I fooled you. And it's I was waiting for you to get to the real point. You know?
If you frame a character like Gendo Ikari and he isn't someone's dad, you better have something fucking amazing to say with that guy. Anyway.
Also, stop framing characters like Gendo Ikari. Literally every mediocre anime does this.
Does that shit.
When they end, it's like, the first 10 episodes have nothing to say, and then 11 and 12, let's rip off Evangelion! Stop doing that! Stop it! It's very, very
At least he had the weird Kazuki Yao voice. Like, at least he had, like, a really weird voice.
Yeah.
Well,
it works in this show, not with fake priest guy, but, I mean, it worked, I think, between Inari and Koto, definitely.
Sure. Yeah, I think a lot of that stuff did work. I didn't really appreciate the visual references to Evangelion that, first of all, are in anime, those are the Star Wars references.
Yes.
Like, don't. No one thinks it's clever anymore. I mean, I still do, but...
Yeah. I really like the relationship between Inari and Koto, but it is very divorced. Like, you're right. Like, it fits the Evangelion ideas more so than the stuff that they tried to frame as Eva, which can very easily and should have been taken out of the show completely. But they needed to get it up to 10 episodes, I guess. So, you know.
So, Brady, which characters did you feel like you sort of attached to the most at first? Who were you the most intrigued by?
So, I mean, like, the episode 00 sort of frames it as, like, Koto's story, and then immediately when you watch it, it's more Mioi's story. And kind of, I kind of wavered in the beginning, because, like, when they got into Koto's background, it's like, oh, this is why she's this way. But Mioi, I feel, is more, like, way more interesting, because, like, I feel like he's, like, a pretty well-realized portrayal of someone who is both depressed and, like, ultimately suicidal. The thing is like, suicidal people and depressed people, they aren't always mopey. They have real lives, and they have good and bad days and everything, and, like, have love lives, jobs, whatever. But ultimately they are still depressed and kind of suicidal. And I think that, like, one of the interesting things about his character is like, he's like, he goes from being resolved to want to pass on again to, being more optimistic, but I think that the way that they show his optimism is way better than I've ever seen it done in any other show, in that, like, when Inari asks him, like, hey, you know, when you die again, will you be glad you stayed alive? And he's like, you know what, I'm not sure, but I hope I feel that way. And it's sort of like, he's got a better outlook, but unlike a lot of other anime where they've been like, oh yeah, I'm cured of this thing forever. Uh-huh. He still has doubts. He still has fears, but he's at least optimistic versus being completely cured, like so many other anime would have, like, played that character.
Yeah, I was gonna say, by the end, he at least finds a reason to live, which is incredibly good.
Right. That's all sort of last half of the show.
Yeah,
but yeah,
we don't spoil it, guys.
Yeah,
we don't
right.
spoil it.
All right.
We are definitely going to spoil that stuff.
yeah, it's hard to talk about the show without
talking about
it, really.
The ending, because it's so short. It is like the run. Like, there's a lot to talk about, but it is short, and the characters' arcs are not long. They're just dense. So yeah, Jacob, did you? I mean. Same answer? Or?
Oh, yeah, my favorite character is Inuyama. This is the golden retriever that they have that lives for a million years. That is actually the loudest noise that I made while watching Kyosukiga was when the dog dies. So the world is kind of ending at the end of Kyosukiga, and everybody fades out like TV static. They disappear, they die. And when the dog went, I was not okay. It wasn't acceptable for them to get rid of the golden retriever.
It's just a drawing.
But no, it's a drawing of a
you
cute dog.
You saved Mioi, man.
Just draw another dog.
It's beautiful. No, don't draw another dog. It's
just draw another dog.
No.
Hey, the dog comes back at the end.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's, you know.
They all do. Right?
But no, character-wise, I didn't. I mostly connected to Mioi. I connected to Koto's story more when it intersected with Mioi's story, and it became, like, it was thematically they're tied. They're the yin and yang. And that's not even, like, a lazy metaphor. They're the yin and yang of the Buddhist metaphor that the show is, like, they're one of, like, three generations of yin and yang. But, like, I connected to Koto a lot more when her struggle was framed against Mioi's. Because Mioi has such a compelling backstory. And the other two, the siblings, well, they are doodles. Like, they have interesting motivations, and they're
inferiority
fun to watch.
Complex. Yeah,
yeah, they're fun and they're important for fleshing out how the cool world works. It's like, well, here's the chaotic mountains where you have this Ojo-sama and all her demons, and here's the kind of orderly city that works on, like, anime rules from the Showa era anime and stuff like that. And you know, it's cute, but they aren't as complex, certainly. So the show is just really all about Mioi and his new little sister Koto.
I do want to interject, actually. Shoko in episode 2 is also someone I relate to deeply. When she's freaking out over losing her controller, I'm like, that's me.
I found those characters totally superfluous, but I
wish they would have fleshed her out more. And she is sort of set up as a more important character than she becomes in the TV series.
She's got a nice character design. All that Benny Maru, that was the guy's name? That's the robot's name? Whatever.
Bishimaru.
That stuff all seemed totally superfluous to me. It seemed like it was important in that that first episode, the 00 episode. It felt like it was important in that version of the story, but in the TV version, it wasn't that important.
Well, they could have. Bishimaru is just a symbol for the wall between worlds, as it were, and you could have used anything else, but they just used a giant robot because why not? But like,
well, they made it a giant robot so Koda would attack it because they wanted her to attack something, and they figured, she would go after this thing.
Right.
That it's really bright and shiny. Ooh, shiny, I'll go after this. Mm-hmm. Even though, in reality, it's not a robot. It's just sort of like the wall.
Yeah, the wall.
Yeah. It serves a story purpose. Mm-hmm. I just felt like maybe it wasn't.
Yeah, well, no, the regulatory agency, the one where Kyoko, is that her name? Shoko. That stuff felt a little superfluous to me. But, I mean, like, they had this much story, and they needed to get it just this much. So it's not, like, super padded, but it's just padded enough where, when they add more ideas, anything that jumps out to you is like, well, this isn't necessary, because the whole thing is this giant conglomeration of different ideas. Anything that goes, that's like one extra straw in the camel's back sticks out, I think, stronger than usual.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, I think they, like, when they were doing the ONA, they had, like, each of the ONA episodes past 00 are dedicated to each character. And then they took those and then expanded them out into full episodes. And it's interesting that Shoko had a full episode just about her in the ONA, and then I guess maybe because they had to reuse so much of the animation, like 90% of the animation from the ONA is reused in the TV series. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can tell if you look at the credits, like episode 1 directed by this person, and this person, that I think they sort of were stuck with using what they had already made, mm-hmm. even though they sort of decided that she was more superfluous to the story than they originally thought.
Oh, and we should say the production staff on this show is Skeleton Cruiseville.
Yeah.
Like, it is Ryo Matsumoto and a handful of her animators and then some outsourcing, but it is like, the credits are like shockingly small for a TV anime, or for a late night anime compared to what I'm used to seeing. I'm like, whoa, that was all the people who worked on this episode? Like, it's Skeleton Cruiseville, definitely.
And sometimes a lot of the animators that worked on it it's all like Pretty Cure people that worked on this. Mm-hmm.
There was a comment
I feel
in the
like
chat.
They work on both shows at the same time.
There was a comment in the chat about the monster siblings all being really important and having their story arcs be super important. I agree with that. The only characters I was talking about were the two people, like the girl and her controller and her like sidekick scientist.
Yeah,
like,
and we were talking about
those guys seemed a little like, I don't know why we're spending time with these people. They don't, you know.
It's not
a major complaint.
Yeah. Oh, we were talking about like what's emotionally compelling, not what's necessary to the story. Like they're extremely Yase and Kurama are extremely necessary to the story.
Yeah, that's like a third of the story.
But like their motivations are so much simpler that it's easier to connect to the two more literally human aspects of the story.
Right.
I would honestly say we were talking about earlier how we're not sure if they even really grow up. Like, if you look at Kurama, I think he didn't grow at all, and I think he sort of put on these affectations to try and make himself feel older and to look more like Mioe, and him being jealous that Mioe gets to grow up and do all these things, whereas he's sort of stuck where he is.
I think Yase ages, though.
Well, the thing is Yase could always change how she looked. Mm-hmm. Like, she could become gigantic and all that sort of stuff. Whereas, like, I think maybe Yase, like, the way that I took it is Yase changed herself to look more like her mother because she adored her so much, whereas Kurama didn't really age, so he was like, I have to make myself look more older and important, and he affected all the robes and the dour demeanor and everything and the floating thing that he has. And it's because like one of the first things that Mioe says to him to sort of get him is like, oh, you know, at least I've grown into my clothes, you know, like that kind of thing. And I think that like his inferiority complex versus Mioe, and he knows that Mioe doesn't even want this. He's like, you have all this and you don't even want this. You get to grow up and do all this sort of stuff, and I can't even do that, you know? Like, I think that's part of his character.
Yeah.
Or at least that's how I took it anyway.
He's like a little counterfeit Buddha, which is a fun idea. Like, all the visual ideas, like, even when there's too many, they're fun. Like, the Ojo-sama look for, you know, this raging, angry demon is a fun idea. And Kurama specifically, like, he's way over adorned. Like, his hat is like the size of his body, and his clothes are way too big for him. And he floats around to make himself look even bigger. He floats around on this little UFO that is actually a sake cup. So it's all like slightly perverted, like Buddha imagery, where he's trying to make himself look like this divine, benevolent order, agent of order and peace. And it's like, but he just looks like a kid playing dress up, which is a neat idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was under the impression that the siblings were intended to be, at least in some way, extensions of the father. Uh-huh. So that their personalities, like, they're not going to change that much because they are individual traits of the father, aspects of his personality sort of given life.
Yeah. Well, in them, he
because he sort of discusses that at the end.
Yeah, that's a big theme in the show. Yeah. In them, I think he is replicating. So he is basically his grandfather is, okay, spoilers. His grandfather is you know, the original, like, god agent of creation and order and everything in the world, and he created two sons to carry on his line, and they kind of represent the ideas of chaos and order in a broad sense. And I'm sure that there is a more specific, like, Taoist or Buddhist terms for this, but in a general sense, it's kind of a yin yang thing where he Mioe, the older Mioe, the father, is the chaos agent, but he's passive, so he didn't really have a lot of power. So I think in creating those drawings, he's like, and I'm gonna make my own chaos and order, and yeah, you're gonna be chaos and you're gonna be order, and then because I'm beginning to realize the importance of human agency in this, I'll also forcefully adopt a human boy.
Yeah.
And you know,
God, I was so worried that they weren't
gonna address that. Yeah,
gonna get
I
into
was
that.
Scary. I was like, this
so
will ruin
concerned,
the show if they don't. But they did.
Episode 8 starts, and like his brother shows up and is like, "Hey, I'm an external threat, and I can show up, and we can just have an anime ending." And I was like,
"Don't do this.
Are you seriously not going to address the dad's being like the most selfish piece of
the
shit in the
dad.
World?
Mm-hmm.
Like everything he did in this show is just a result of it. The entire show is a result of his selfishness. Uh-huh. Please tell me you're going to confront that." And thankfully they did, and the show totally comes together.
But briefly,
I don't agree with that entirely. That like, I mean, I do think that Inari Mioe is like a loathsome asshole, but like, it's more all the fact of like him being like of having self hatred and self doubt in himself that anyone could ever love him. So I more see it as that, oh, he created these other people so he would have people to love him, or he would have people to love in return.
Right, but he also had, I think, big expectations of them.
That's justification for it.
Uh-huh.
That's his justification, mm-hmm. But it's not an excuse. And
well, no, but
the stuff that he does in the show, like, it comes together at the end in spite of him, not because of him.
Mm-hmm.
There's a happy ending because his kids pulled his head out of his ass. Mm-hmm. Like, that's Kyosugiga.
And it is positive, and I would say almost, like, a little too optimistic, but it's okay because it fits the tone of the show. It couldn't be too dark that they forgive him and accept him back into their lives, because by all rights, they shouldn't have to.
So, like, so yes. I may have sounded this whole time like I was a little lukewarm on the show, and I was for most, you know, the first half of its runtime. The show totally grabbed me, and I totally was like, oh, shit, this is really good, is when they reveal the main character's backstory.
Yes.
That is when the show totally grabbed me. It was the main character's backstory is that his family died in front of him, his house was burning down, and he kills himself.
Mm-hmm.
And the priest wanders over to him and brings him back to life against his will, and then he's immortal against his will.
Mm-hmm.
And this is treated as like, oh, you'll be fine. And it's like, can you put yourself mentally in that situation?
And it's screwed up. Like, he's like, I'm your dad now.
That
you're
is
my kid.
Fucked
I'm your dad.
Up.
And this
is
your new mama.
That is,
and I'm going to make
yeah.
you, and I'm going to make you siblings.
I give Rie Matsumoto like huge points for coming up with one of the most fucked up father son things
yeah.
I have seen. Like, that is just world class
mm-hmm.
fucked up dad
mm-hmm.
kind of thing.
That is where I think I was like, okay, this is something else. I've got to keep, you know, I've got to keep going on this show.
And before that, I was like, this is a neat aesthetic exercise, but it's not really totally grabbed me. But then it grabbed me, and then the end of the show really got me too.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, for me, it was always like the show. The first episode is still, I think, like one of the best first episodes I've ever seen in anime. And I was like, wow, this is something really good. And then, like, you know, when they have Mioe's backstory, I'm like, wow, this show is actually really, really, really good. If they can stick the landing, this show will probably be one of my favorites. And then it did. And I'm like, wow, this is a really damn good show.
Yeah, like, I mean, I think, like, his backstory is, like, I was talking again, like, the him being a suicidal character and sort of forcing a character like that to live no matter what. You have to imagine, like, how maddening that is. And then he lived in the mirror world for how many years? Like, hundreds or something?
Like, yeah, 800 years.
Yeah, like, and so he's stuck there with the siblings. This guy who's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to bring you back to life. And you have a mom and dad and all this sort of stuff. Oh, we're bailing, bye. And, like, leaves him there. And then, like, you can understand where, like, why there's all this infighting between all these three characters who are essentially in charge of this thing that can't really change at all. And then, like, he's, like, sort of, like, a dick the whole time. The father is, like, kind of like this asshole dick. Like, it's very rare that, like, when at the very end when Kodo just straight up decks him, like, I'm, like, I was like, cheering. I was, like, yes, because he really deserves that. Like, he just really deserves that wake up.
Yeah,
I mean, a lot of the shows also, it feels like it's them trying to escape, you know, like the shadow of their father, of Inari, and then it's just, in the end, all of them, they end up just retracing and just, you know, retracing his steps and just making all the same mistakes he made.
Right, that was the thing that really helped me come around to the show. Like, so I was becoming more endeared to it a little earlier than Zach was, because the thing I really connected to is that, a lot of Japanese screenwriters write about family relationships and stuff like that. And some are more saccharine, some are more dark in ways that are over the top enough to not be, you know, like, I like dark family stuff when it feels real and it deals with the nuance of and the difficulty of living with a bad family. But some of it, like, I'm gonna pick a real bad example. Assassination Classroom. I absolutely hated how that show treated the ideas of having a bad family. That show gets it wrong completely. If I had to pick a poster child for, like, this is not how abuse works, this is not how it affects children, screw this. But Kyosugiga so rides the line between, like, family is great, family is really important, and sometimes your family's bad. And it rides the line really, really well, and I started resonating even before I knew that it was Bad Dad, and I started getting really worried when it looked like they were going to just forgive him because here's this external threat. Thank God that was just red herring. Even before that, I really related to how the siblings were pitted against each other just by a natural extension of the bad parenting, of the abandonment. And, you know, and they had a loving, caring mother, but she, again, was sort of this passive figure to the more active dad who just sort of used his agency to abandon them. And this forcibly pits them against each other, even though they love each other very much and they need each other. There is this sense of competition and animosity and bitterness that comes from all the bad ways that they were raised. And I really, really resonated with that. I thought that it was it wasn't exaggerated and it wasn't sugarcoated. It just felt very real. So I started attaching pretty quickly to the way that the siblings related. Mm. And then by the time we got around to the big themes, the big, like, cosmic themes of Sins of the Father stuff, I thought it was really good. So I really started falling in love with the show. I started being like, oh, this is really, really good. When they illustrated, like you said, Dylan, like, just how perfectly they start, even though they disagree with. Sometimes Kodo idolized her father. Mioe did not like him. And Mr. Boston is being very loud.
Jeez, Boston.
Waiting.
Pick him up, put him on the camera. But anyway, like, so Kodo idolized her dad, and Mioe the second did not, you know, resented him. But they both end up just repeating their dad's sins, and which is a problem because a lot of it's not just the sins of the father, but also the reason the sins of their father repeat is because the whole fuck you dad thing. It's okay. The whole fuck you dad thing comes from a place of rebelling against what you think your dad wants. So it creates this problem where the dad does bad things because his father forced expectations on him that he couldn't fulfill, and then he forces expectations on his children that they can't fulfill, which caused them to hate their father, and, like, that's where that comes from. So fully addressing, like, the sins of the father isn't some weird fate thing that doesn't have any basis in psychology, fully addressing that it comes from a desire to push back against the expectations that are put on you because this guy is trying to make up for the mistakes that he made in his past because his dad put expectations on him. It is a cyclical thing. And so they tie that into the whole cyclical nature of sin that's sort of in Buddhism and attachment and stuff like that. And it was great. I was like, oh, that's really, really thoughtful. And it doesn't feel too big or too abstract. It's very homey. The characters relate to each other like family members. So yeah, that was what endeared me most in the show.
Yeah, it had that good... Okay. I watched a lot of anime and a lot of Japanese films. Uh-huh. The way Japanese filmmakers and storytellers talk about and present family uh-huh. is somewhat different from the way American filmmakers do. Uh-huh. This has that good... there's something specific about the sort of Japanese sensibility about family that this show... It's there in Summer Wars... Uh-huh. Some of the One Piece stuff has it too, but it has it at the end of the show really strongly, and I appreciated that a lot. The way the show talks about family is it's familiar. It'll be familiar to you if you watch a lot of anime, but it does it really, really well. Like, you know, the old canard, it's like you can do stuff that you've seen before, but if you do it really exceptionally well, it doesn't, you know, it comes across as fresh. And this certainly did.
Right.
In the end.
Well, I was going to say, there's another show from that same year that is kind of similar to that, but not as visually abstract as The Eccentric Family, which deals with a lot of the same things that Kyosuke Giga does, but on a more subdued nature.
Yeah, Eccentric Family is like we're down to earth talking about these issues in a very, like, moment-to-moment, how people relate sort of way, and the family's mostly okay. Like, it is really, like, for the Eccentric Family, little dysfunctions, I guess, grief. A big thing is loss and grief that is separated.
Yeah.
It is true in Kyosuke Giga, but in Kyosuke Giga, they're waiting for him to come back. It's not...
It's more on a cosmic scale, so...
Yeah, and Kyosuke Giga is like, no, the family's bad. Things are bad, and we're elevating this to a cosmic scale, and it's more abstract, without being, like, sort of totally cold and allegorical, like a lot of the stuff does. It's the way people talk and stuff like that is still very natural and, like, homey, which is usually those things aren't connected that way, but, like, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Brady, tell us what you felt, how you felt about the end of the show and, you know, how it all came together for you. What was the thing that you took away? Like, when you think about Kyosuke Giga, what did it say to you specifically that resonated the strongest?
I mean, like, the themes of, like, you know, working on your depression, that kind of thing, that really spoke to me, but also that, like, sort of, like, no matter, you know, even if your family's not blood or whatever, and no matter how dysfunctional your family is, you can work it out. I mean, like, I think, like, especially with Inari at the end, he's like, you know... I'm nothing now. I have nothing now. And, you know, his dad is like, hey, you know, you have this whole family you made. You shouldn't take that for granted. Like, this is the world you made. This is the home you made. This is the family you made. You can't take that for granted. And, you know, they begrudgingly accept him back in despite all of his bad behavior. And, like, I think, I mean, it's, you know, all in all, I think, like, a hopeful, you know, sort of the hope of it. And especially, like, again, you know, Mioi's character really resonated with me. So him actually being able to reconcile with his father is, like, a huge deal, especially with, you know, this guy essentially tormented him for hundreds of years. Like, he doesn't want to be there, and he's there for 800 years dealing with people that he didn't ask to deal with. He didn't ask for brothers or sisters or a family after all that happened. The family he loved was gone. And I think that that struggle there is sort of what I took there's a way to surmount that. And you can, and no matter what the circumstances are, you can find some semblance of happiness, even if you're not completely sure of it all at the end.
I like that it does that without justifying what the father did. Like, it is like, oh, yeah, you shouldn't kill yourself. You should move on and embrace the future and not the... let go of the past, but without saying, like, and that's why it's okay that he did this terrible thing to you. Like, he has able to recognize this thing himself through gaining this little sister.
The show does not reject you if you're flawed.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you can be, but also you can actually be straight up fucked up and abusive, and this show will still embrace you.
Well, no, but it doesn't. Here's the thing: his embrace of the future is his own. He's able to find a reason to live on his. In fact, he couldn't do that waiting for his dad because he very much failed to do that waiting for his dad. He was only like able to use the stuff that his dad had given him for his own reasons once he rejected that this is what his dad wanted for him, and he's like, well, that's not why I'm doing this. I'm doing this to take care of my little sister, who I have embraced as my real sibling, and who I've come to love and take care of. Like, it is, you know, it doesn't justify, because it would have been very easy, especially because they do let him back into their lives at the end, for Kiyosugiga to justify that guy's horrible decisions, but it never does. And so they do forgive him, and you can definitely take issue with that, but, like, it is, they don't say that. Well, they don't at any point say that anything that he did was like, well, really, it was for the best. No, not at all.
No, I think it's stronger because they don't try to fix it. Like, say his mistakes weren't mistakes. He's laid bare at the very end, and they still forgive him, which is a very different kind of solution than a lot of anime. Like, well, this is all for your own good. But no, he was a shit and selfish, and they make it obvious that. That was the real way it was. There's no sugarcoating it.
Well, they go through a couple of different phases of Inari's problems. They work through, like, layer after layer, and the show has to take several episodes getting through all of them. Mm-hmm. By the end, they're breaking down by the very end, they're breaking down Inari's self-hatred and actually confronting his self-hatred having turned into wild narcissism, which is actually something that I write about a little bit. But they confront that within a span of about 3 minutes at the end. And I was like, whoa, you're really onto something there. Like, you could have had a whole show just about that part. But
a lot of ideas.
A lot of ideas, right? But I connected really hard with that, obviously. Obviously, I connect with that. And but they spent like a couple lines really at the end on that, and that's a major thing, and I was a little like, I connected really hard with it, but I wanted more. I wanted them to explore that a little bit more, and like, it was just one of Inari's, like, they really built a character with like every kind of bad dad thing in it.
I abandon you and I force my expectations on you.
And he's God.
And I'm obsessed
and
with
it's God. And he and he bestowed all of his powers to you. Like, it's everything bad about a father figure, like, in one thing.
How do you force unreasonable expectations on somebody that they can't escape and abandon them at the same time? He found a way.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I will tell you that, like,
him of his ability to escape the situation.
Yeah.
He literally took away his ability to die.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
I'm still having nightmares about that.
I will tell you that working on the script for that last episode and making sure it was all, like, actually accurate to the Japanese and everything was the biggest minefield that I've ever. Like,
I can't even imagine, dude.
Kudos to you guys, though, because those subtitles, like, they were definitely improved from the original translation, because I had trouble following it. That was one of the reasons I quit halfway through. Like,
so I realized I was the victim of a scam here, but Brady came to me and was like, don't watch the subtitles that are illegally available streaming. Mm-hmm. They will not make any sense. Mm-hmm. And I watched a little bit of those subtitles, and
they're pretty rough.
Yeah. So he's like, you should buy the Blu-ray version that I just happened to work on. And so I bought that, and good thing I did, because the translation was great. It made great sense. And that's a great set. Although I do have a beef, Brady, on the menus. Why does on disc one the menus above? Why is there an option in the menus that just says close? What is that?
And when you're playing the movie,
just on the first menu screen, it just says close above all the episodes. Why?
When you start it up?
Yes.
It shouldn't do that when you start it up. Close should only be when you are playing the show.
Maybe it was doing that, and I was just confused. Mm. I don't know, man.
No,
it threw me. It was on the main screen.
I mean, mine were
fine. It was totally on the main screen. Anyway, all right, now I know where it's supposed to go. That threw me.
Yeah.
But you did a really nice job on those discs. If you're going to watch the show, get the official one. Get the official one. Get the Blu-ray version or the DVD version, I guess, because that's,
makes a lot more sense. It's a lot more
for a show like this that feels like it's everything.
Yeah,
it's totally it's completely crucial. Like you,
I will say big thanks to my buddy Steven Siddall, who sat there with me night after night when I would go over sections of the show. I'm like, okay, well, we need to look at this translation, and like, 'cause this doesn't seem right. And we spent so long because I knew that this show was so sort of nuanced, especially with the ending, that I had to get it as close to perfect as I can. There's still stuff in that show though that we couldn't figure out that's accurate, but like there's one line where one of the kids is like, this is liquid crystal or something like that, and that's what it says and that's what's in the actual script. We had the original Japanese script and that's what he's saying, but it's like, what does that mean? So there's even stuff that we couldn't figure out. But like,
I remember that line.
Yeah. Oh, I remember. Because I remember all the lines that gave me trouble. There's one that like where Kodos is talking to Kurama and she's like, they're talking about like how adults have like messed with them in the past. And she's like, yeah, I had a bad experience. And she's like, but appearance is important to me or something like that. And that line went through so many retranslations to try and figure out exactly what they meant, because it's not like a lot of the in the show, it's some of it's vague and it's not always clear. So there went like a lot went into that. And I'm glad it makes me really happy that it actually all came across to you guys and that you feel like it was worth watching the version over the other one.
Please continue.
Oh, I'm glad Boston likes Kyosuke too. He has a lot of things to say.
He spotted another cat outside, which is why he switched normal meowing to like frantic, deep level meowings.
I'm sorry. So I wanted to pose that earlier question to Dylan that I posed to Brady. So ultimately, what was the biggest thing? Like when you think about the show, what is the thing that you think about? Like what was your takeaway?
I think my biggest takeaway from the show is just that, like, it's a very compelling family drama that, you know, has a lot to say about, like, the love of family members and the importance of that and the ideas of, like, rebirth from that as well. As well as this show has some, like, really great visuals. It is perfectly directed, I feel. I feel like it's an incredible show all around. It hits a lot of both storytelling and visual aesthetics I just love a lot. And like how Brady was talking about, like it has a lot to say about like, you know, suicide and stuff like that. It's really hard for me to put in words why I love it so much, but it's just a great show.
That makes sense.
I'm sorry.
No, hey,
sorry,
dude, that makes sense.
I'm like rambling all about it. It's just that like, it's really hard for me to put into words why I love this show so much. It's just, it does a lot of visual and storytelling aesthetics that just hit really hard with me.
It is tough to talk about the show. I while I was sitting there watching it, I found it a little tough maybe to process and to sit there and think about it critically, think about it actively, because it's a little it's overwhelming. But watching the show is overwhelming.
And yeah,
it makes it a little tough to sit there and crunch it because you really have to work overtime.
All this stuff we're talking about, we didn't really like. We're trying to talk about it.
It's not like you sit there watching it and go, "Oh, yeah, yeah."
It's not like
here's the one point I take from the show. There's not one thing to take from it either. Mm-hmm. It's just so many different. Like saying it's really dense.
But I do think like the two biggest things are definitely the idea of like family love and also forgiveness are definitely like, I think probably the two biggest reasons that this show means a lot to me. You know, the idea of like forgiving your family for what they've done to you and I don't know, stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. Jacob, what about you?
For me, the biggest thing was, sort of basically tying in the Buddhist angle in a way that made it very human instead of being about the religion.
Yeah, I know the basics of Buddhism well enough. I took a few classes in college and I retained a lot of that, it turns out. I really appreciated the way this show wove that stuff in. You know, the apocalyptic religious imagery in something like Evangelion is in there as a metaphor for what those feelings feel like. It's intended to be bombastic. It's not intended to invoke any actual religious meaning. It just people always say, like, it just looks cool. It doesn't mean anything. I mean, it does mean something metaphorically, just not what you think.
It's divorced from its original.
And it's not a deep meaning. Mm. It's fairly shallow. It's just these feelings are apocalyptic and grandiose, and this is what they feel like when you're 16. Mm. That's why there's a giant cross in Evangelion. Anyway,
I mean, the best...
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry, go ahead. No, I was going to say, there's one piece of symbolism in the show that always kind of stood out to me, and it's the... this is kind of a spoiler about the pomegranate that Inari feeds Miyoe when he finds him dying. It's also, you know, the fruit of the pomegranate is tied, you know, to Persephone from Greek mythology.
Yeah, and it's a mix of stuff. There's
the pomegranate actually is maybe one of my least favorite symbols in it, just because I feel like it breaks. Like, the show is so Japanese and slightly Chinese, and the pomegranate is like, here's Greek myth, and it's like, you don't have any other Greek myths in here. Stop it. Stop it. Like, but like, it's not a big deal. It's just a small, like, nitpick where it's like, first of all, that's a very, very recognizable symbol, so it's both good and bad, in that it's super recognizable, so everybody will be like, oh, I understand what this means. But also because it's like, a lot of these are really creative symbols that you kind of created out of whole cloth, and this one's a little bit not lazy, what's the word? I don't know. It's boilerplate. And,
expected.
Expected.
Very expected.
Expected. But, like...
Creation myth with the pomegranate involved, why I never.
And, but it is... but, I mean, like, it does work. So, you know, if it works, why mess with it? If it's not broke, don't fix it. But, like, yeah, that was actually the one thing that bothered me, as I was like, that's... Mm-hmm. But, I mean, maybe there's an equivalent... I know that there's, like, Fruit of the Underworld stuff in Japanese mythology, too. I don't think it's specifically a pomegranate, but maybe... You know, so they can go, haha, it counts.
And then like, Miyoe passes it on to Kodo, too, in that insert scene, which is sort of completely randomly in there.
Well, I mean, I think it was important as he sees a kindred spirit in her, but also he's kind of dooming her to his own expectations. Mm-hmm. Like, he does. He's an older brother, but Miyoe begins to repeat the sins of his father by going, oh, you will fulfill my unfulfilled expectations and needs in life, which is, you know, it's the theme. But that's what I was saying, is the thing that spoke to me most is the idea of breaking cycles of attachment and sin and stuff like that is shifted into breaking cycles of family expectations based on your affection, your attachment to them, your affection for them that sometimes isn't even wanted, like, especially in the case of Miyoe. And being able to live for yourself and embrace the family that you've chosen over family expectations that are sort of ingrained in you and passed down in this very, like, recursive, harmful way, you know? So I found that most meaningful. And I guess this isn't really a theme, but just, like, I really appreciated the dialogue was so good.
Mm. The dialogue is really well written, like, just from a dialogue perspective.
Yeah, like, everybody gets...
Good script.
They get across the themes really well without... saying things that people don't say.
It repeats itself a lot at the end, but that's okay.
The biggest flaw of the show to me is it has too many, not just too many ideas, but too many climaxes.
Too many.
12 climaxes. Take 5 of those out, guys. 5 of them you don't need, like the story music, like the score is
rising action music, where everyone's like, okay, guys,
we gotta rally
this time
together.
We gotta get you, gotta rally around for, like, every episode is like that in the last
half. Of episode
it's
9.
Exhausting.
Are you gonna do this for 2 straight episodes?
It's fucking exhausting.
Yeah, but,
plus,
but,
like, that many emotional revelations stacked on top of one another becomes cringy to me after a while. It gets a little...
Episode 9 really unloads a lot. It's kind of exhausting at points.
Yeah, where it's like, but really? It's all this? And everyone goes, what? What? And then they do that again, like, 4 times for the rest of the episode. It's just, it becomes a little much. But those are nitpicks. Those are minor little... Mm-hmm.
Is episode 9 when they get to Inari's father, or is that 10? I can't remember when he shows up.
That's 10.
Inari's dad 10. Just shows
That's
up.
The end of 9? Okay.
Yeah.
That was also kind of a, okay, guys, like, it's another climax, you know. But, you know, it's a minor nitpick. Like, so, I my takeaway is I enjoyed the show a lot. It's not one of my... all-time favorites personally, just because it forced me to engage with it a lot more intellectually than emotionally, and just because there are simply too many notes.
It's not an easy show to watch at all. It's not easy to watch.
I was gonna say, on the opposite,
it's really good. It's really good, and I really enjoyed watching it. It didn't really speak directly to my heart, except in some moments, because it is a little bit more. It was a little bit more of an intellectual exercise for me than an emotional one.
Yeah, but, I think maybe that was. I didn't really connect any of the characters too hard until about halfway, a little more than halfway through it. And before that, I was honestly a little bored. So my takeaway from Kyosuke was like, that was like a B plus, A minus. Like, I didn't fall in love with it like I did, like, From the New World or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm super glad. I do feel like this is an anime that go, even though that's my personal reaction to it, mm-hmm. I would still put this on a you need to see this.
Yeah, no, it's
from
really
the
good.
2010s. It's really like good. Absolutely shoots onto that list of you have to see this. If you're interested in anime as a medium, you need to watch this show as part of your education, as part of if you're interested in it, you should watch this.
Mm-hmm. I do think
immediately
it's
on that list.
It's definitely, as I said before, it's definitely my favorite show of the 2010s so far.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it just occurred to me, like,
my cat agrees with you, Dylan.
Yeah. I think that it just occurred to me after seeing the full thing of Kyosukika and not just the very beginning, but the first half. It feels like the very beginning, considering how much is wadded into the second half. But, like, I think it really strikes me, like, Ryo Matsumoto's really was, like, the perfect pick to take on Yasuhiro Naito's work for Blood Blockade, because, like, they have a lot in common in terms of how they write characters and in terms of how they embrace, like, chaos as its own sort of good and all sorts of stuff. But, like, also... Boston's being a stinkhead, but also it hadn't occurred to me, but like I think like Kyosugiga is the most, like, it's the best integration of like exploring aspects of a religion through a very like through a humanistic lens instead of a religious lens. Like it explores Buddhism through humanism in a really good way, and continuing, Yasuhiro Naito has a particular fascination with exploring Christianity through humanism. It's like discarding the more dogmatic aspects of the religion and talking about what's meaningful about it spiritually in a humanistic way. And he does this in Blood Blockade as well. And so, and she got that, and she captured it really well. So she did that with Buddhism and then Christianity. And it's like, oh, I think this is another strength of her that I hadn't realized. Because the stuff that jumps out immediately is she's really good at writing sibling relationships and stuff like that. But I think she also has the talent for that as well.
Mm-hmm.
For me, like, I've talked about the stuff that I sort of took away from it, but I appreciated a lot the fact that the show leaned very heavily on, at the end anyway, in the last, like, there were, I would say about 5 minutes at the end dedicated to, you blow everything out into these giant cosmic proportions and you act like everything is this huge, like, you talk about it in these grandiose melodramatic ways that then drag everyone screaming into this nightmare of melodrama. Not only that, but you need to understand that love is not this perfect, cosmic, beautiful thing. It is just these moments that you share with the people that you love. That's it. It's just, mm-hmm. it's the fights that you have and the times where you're just quiet together. And, you know, that's what love is. Stop expecting it to be this
thing that's going to fix you.
Yeah, this thing that's going to fix you, this thing that's going to represent what the meaning of life is. Like, it's just love. That's what love is. It's simple and small and beautiful. That was a big thing.
I was going to say, also, I felt like that the show does that in a way where the first episode starts with, like, the very idealist idea of, like, what love is. And each episode, I feel, slowly more and more kind of picks away at, no, actually, it's not like it is always shown in fairy tales. It's actually more, there's more to it than just that.
Yeah. Speaking of fairy tales, we are mere hours away from seeing Beauty and the Beast.
Why you gotta bring that
I
up?
I know. Well, I'm just so excited to hear you complain about it.
I'm gonna be as noisy as Boston is now.
Yeah, the theater, they're gonna kick us out for sure. But we should get to our Twitter questions about the show. Hang on just a second while I pull up our Twitter cues.
Boston, entertain the people. If you're going to be this noisy, you have to contribute to the discussion.
Just one moment. Okay. For Jacob, Redcar asks, what did you think of Goshina's soundtrack? Would you like to see Matsumoto and him collaborate again in the future?
So, Kyosugi's soundtrack, I have a beef with.
Me too.
Helsing.
Oh, no.
Helsing is a show, not Helsing Ultimate, but Helsing TV. Is a show, this is the poster child that I use for this when I'm talking about anime. Helsing has a fantastic soundtrack. It is used very poorly in the show. Basically, the way they use Helsing's soundtrack, well, Helsing's kind of poorly directed in general, but, like, the way they use Helsing's soundtrack in the show is, like, it sounds like there's always a radio off-screen playing the song. And that's a problem. Basically, you need to use the soundtrack in a way that enhances what you're seeing visually, and it doesn't separate these two tracks in your mind, where you can hear, it's like, oh, that's good music, oh, what am I looking at, and they don't mesh. So, Kioski has a similar problem. It has a fantastic soundtrack. It's really beautiful. Like, it's melodramatic without feeling like boilerplate orchestral stuff. It's really good music, but it doesn't really fit. And Ryu Matsumoto is a fantastic storyboard artist. Here's the thing: we haven't talked very much about how Kyoko Sugiga, like I said, animation skeleton crew. There's not much animation in the show. What is there is very passionate and sort of web Jenny, and you know, like I
and fucking brilliant design, and yes, just like a design. Mountain of a genius fucking
and,
design.
But there's a lot of different angles, and the storyboarding is very crisp and perfect. Like the only time that it's like, oh, you're letting me down, was episode 8, where it really does, like, it's a slog. But other than that, it's extremely watchable for a thing that has to cut corners a lot on animation.
The backgrounds, especially. There's that shot where Mioe and Kodo are going into the country, and it's a profile shot. And you see all that stuff behind them, and it's the passage of time. And that's, like, that whole sequence is beautiful. Especially because, like, it also gets across, like, them becoming real siblings and without a lot of dialogue. And it goes from them being annoyed with each other to being thoughtful and the time change. That whole sequence is beautiful, I think.
I'll say, like, even though the show isn't very well animated, I still think it's expertly directed.
Yeah. Well, like, when we say animation, we literally just mean movement.
And
that's it.
What I was trying to be very complimentary to Ryu Matsumoto. Like, this show is not that well animated. It is Toei, you guys. It's Toei, even though it's talented animators. It's, like, three of them, you know, at Toei. And, but her direction is really superb. Like it really compensates for the lack of animation, except in episode 8. But like it is otherwise, like that show looks great because she just directed the shit out of it and knew exactly when to cut and when it was going to look flat and when to cut around it, and so it gave it a little more life. But she didn't seem to be real great at incorporating the soundtrack with the visuals in a way that meshed, and it didn't just feel like the score. Basically, the score is great, but it feels overactive almost all the time, which is weird because the visuals are so gorgeous. You're like, oh, how could you have an overactive score with stuff that's this visually compelling? But it just doesn't mesh. She just didn't. It's not her strength as a director. I don't think she really understood how to mesh the soundtrack and the visuals. Interesting. Blockade. While it is not fantastic at that by any means, it's a big improvement. The soundtrack didn't jump out to me as like, this seems extraneous and doesn't match the tone of the scene. And Blood Black Eye, basically at all. It didn't strike me as like masterful. Like Shinichiro Watanabe is a master at incorporating a soundtrack to visuals. Like he's great at it. But like she's not a master of it, but she did get better for Blood Black Eye. But yeah, to answer your question, Kyosuke Kika, beautiful soundtrack. It is not Matsumoto got better at this, but it's not well.
I kept thinking Gandalf was going to show up.
Yeah, it's a bit.
I gotta disagree with you, Jacob. I really like how the soundtrack is used in that show a lot.
Oh yeah, it's just a matter of opinion. Like all this stuff is, but I was constantly thinking. I wasn't looking to think this way, but I was constantly thinking the score is overacting. It's like put this here, move this a little bit. Like this, you know, it isn't.
It sounds like someone took like Yoko Kanno tracks from Escaflowne and then like got a bigger orchestra to play them and then played them like louder and then put them in that show.
Yeah, well that's the other thing is the mix.
It's fucking amazing music, but it just doesn't seem like it fits the show.
The biggest mistake she makes is that there's crescendos in the music where this is like the feature
point. Yeah, and they hit parts that there's no.
They hit parts where people are talking a lot.
Yeah.
Don't do that. Don't mix the people talking a lot about really important things with the like don't do that. It's too much. It's too much information. Your brain's going to separate it. But anyway, like really, really good soundtrack, a little bit poor mix, but it's not Helsing. Helsing is forever going to be the poster child to me of, like, you had this amazing soundtrack and you just sort of, like, slapped it on the show and it doesn't really match what we're looking at. Anyway.
I like it.
I think there's definitely moments of it that are done well. Like, I think the vocal track at the end when Mioe is running to confront Koto about the whole ordeal at the very end when everybody disappears. Like, I think that was used all right. And, you know, I thought that was used well. I did like the way that the ending theme song segued in from the show into the ending credits, the swell of that. But, like, I do see what some of what Jacob is saying too, where it's like, well, this is way overwhelming and too much in certain parts.
Yeah, I'm not saying it never works, not at all. Like, sometimes it definitely works, but it if there's ever a point where I'm like, what? And then it's a problem. And I was like, what? At least once an episode, usually. So, yeah, it's just a... But, hey, she obviously got much better at combining those things for Blood Blockade, so, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The Flu 54 wants to know, do you think the unusual production history starting as a series of ONAs hurt the coherency of the show early on?
Yes.
No.
Oh, we have two conflicting answers.
Differing opinions.
Yeah. It did. The show was incoherent at the beginning to the point where I was losing interest. And so was it for all of you.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Zach.
I was just saying, at the beginning, the show is incoherent to the point of me losing interest, and half of you dropped the show as well after watching the first, like, three or four. So I don't think I'm alone on that. I think in hindsight, you wouldn't say that.
Stuff going on.
What's that, Dylan?
I dropped it because I had real people stuff. I had, like, real life stuff going on. Oh, sure.
Well, same thing for me. I absolutely would have watched the rest of the show. But you're right. If it was super compelling, I would have watched it and tried to combine it with my work. So, I don't know. But, like, I don't think it hurts the show. I think it's just, it only gets stronger as it goes, which is...
It gets so strong.
I would prefer...
I'm just not taking it easy on the first half.
I would prefer, it being strong 100% of the way through, but it is like... And yeah, it's good at the beginning. It's never bad. But like, I guess I can appreciate a slow build when it pays off as well as Kosugi.
There's nothing wrong with a show that's got a barrier of entry. It's fine.
I mean,
be honest about it with people up front.
It has a barrier of entry.
If you tell people about...
If we have not made that clear, it has a huge barrier of entry.
If you tell people that up front, they're more like... If you're just honest with them about it, like, hey, this show has a little bit of a barrier of entry. You got to see it, but watch it when you're like in the mood for it. In the mood to real crunch
on something.
I mean,
I would definitely say it's a show you need to be in a mood to watch.
Then they'll get there. But if you just insist, this show is great, and if you don't watch it, you're a stupid asshole, then you lose people.
That's not what Dylan is saying.
I'm not saying that's what Dylan was saying.
What I'm saying is, like, I was instantly sold on that first episode. And the first two episodes, the first one, then the one about Akota's backstory, just sold me instantly on just what the show was trying to tell.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Right. No, it makes sense.
I think I've thought about this a lot, and I think that it's a little bit more complicated than that. I think that the staggered production of it, you know, it being like two or three different things, is partially a detriment to it, but I think also partially sort of makes it the kind of show it is. The reason it might be a little scatterbrained is because of this, but then again, that sort of is kind of the DNA of it. I also think, too, that, like, the fact that they decided to, even with the TV series, to throw the episode 00 on there, I think that just adds, like, I think the first half is probably less of a slog if you don't watch that first. Like, if you don't go in and say...
I think, on the one hand, it spoils a lot, and it's not going to make any sense. But on the other hand, it does make those first episodes more compelling, because you're like, well, I know this stuff's going to connect.
I knew it. Like, that, I appreciated that, because I felt like it gave me some idea of what was going to happen. It was okay that it spoiled it for me a little bit ahead of time, because it doesn't give you enough pieces to put the story together at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it does give you, like, here's what to expect. Hey, this is going to be really confusing, and it's going to feel like your brain got put in a blender for a little while. Mm-hmm. Just stick with it, though. Mm-hmm. Like, I, as a roadmap where I filled in the pieces as I went along, mm-hmm. I appreciated it at first. It was like having
and
a little
next
map.
Time Lady Koto shows up, it'll be less tongue. And yeah. Daughter's
Jeez. Really stuck on that one, huh?
It was such a weird choice that I understand 100% completely, but it was like, I could see why you went, oops, maybe not.
All right, this is for Jacob, really. Forgetful, though anyone can take it. Forgetful Viking wants to know if Rei Matsumoto should spend more time on original works like Kyosugiga or adaptive works like Blood Blockade Battlefront. I feel as though there's a discourse around Rei Matsumoto where people sort of dictate whether or not she should do one thing or the other.
She should do whatever she damn well wants
which,
to.
Which, that's sort of my attitude.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't seen a ton of that, but I've seen a little bit of, like, she shouldn't waste her time on it. Man, she wants...
Blood
anime industry just needs to give her more work is what they need to do.
Yeah. People that are weird about her working on Blood Blockade, like, so, first of all, we don't know that she came up with the concept for Kyosuke. We know she wrote a lot of it, but she also wrote a lot of Blood Blockade. All that anime original stuff is, like, Ryo Matsumoto wrote this. But, like, also, like, people treating it like she was just assigned this and she did the best she could. Like, that lady obviously, it makes sense with her stylistic approach. It's very similar to Night Owls. Like, they have similar aesthetics. And she said, like, Trigun is one of her favorite manga of all time. Like, it makes sense that she would want to have worked on that.
I saw, like, a long Reddit thread about this. It put me off. I was like, man, you Reddit boys.
It's like, you know, she's probably not working on season two because of the thing she did that was ill-advised, but really, like, the stones to go, let's make the last episode. There's going to be a three-month delay. I'm probably not going to get to work on another season because there's a three-month delay, but I'm going to make the last episode of Blood Blockade double length and pour all of my energy into it. Like, she didn't want to work on that show. She obviously wanted to work on that show and cared about it very deeply. Why are people weird about that? But she should do whatever she wants. If she wants to do another adaptation, if she wants to do an original idea, like, she should do whatever inspires her, because when she's inspired, she's going to put out her best work.
Listen, this is... I'm not saying that she should do either, but I do want to see a Trigun Maximum anime
that is directed by her.
That is all I'm asking for.
It's probably not going to happen, but I would, like, piss myself and then explode. Like, I would
more people should have bought that mediocre movie. Yeah. Trigun.
Hey, Aliens, I bought that Rumble.
Movie. Yeah. I did too.
Buy another 500,000 copies.
The manga, so the Trigun manga did sell really well after Blood Blockade, but I don't think that means. But yeah, if they did like a Hellsing Ultimate treatment for that manga, I would just be so happy. I want to see that animated so much because it's impossible to animate. But Ryo Matsumoto proved on a TV budget that it's possible to animate Naito's crazy, terrible drawings, terrible, awesome drawings. So please make a Trigun Maximum OVA series. I will die. Please do it.
Trigun is more popular here than in Japan, right? Is that
yes?
That's true.
Definitely.
And the movie underperformed a little bit here. Although I feel like if the
movie wasn't good, so.
Okay.
Hey, I like that movie.
I like that movie a little bit more than you did, but I feel like it was put in theaters at a time when, like, that wasn't, like, a thing. Like, now I feel like if you opened up a Trigun movie in theaters, it would probably do better than it did back then. That's just my feeling.
Yeah.
Mostly because now this feels like they know how to promote theatrical screenings.
Yeah, that was also pretty
underpromoted. That was a big part of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm.
Let's see here. That actually does it for Twitter questions. Do we have anything from the chat? Any questions from the chat? Anybody? Anybody? We got time for one from the chat. How's it going, Dylan?
It's going.
Yeah,
it's going good.
Just wait. I gotta wait for the chat to catch up to the stream, and then
Okay.
Sometimes somebody will have a question for us right at the end. And I usually give it a little time, but it seems like we pretty much talked about everything there was to say. This guy wants to know what your favorite Rie Matsumoto episode is from Fresh Precure, Dylan.
Oh, Jesus. I don't remember what episode she directed.
Name them in order.
Name the scenes
she directed herself. Name the ones she storyboarded.
If it's any consolation, I the Pretty Cure movie she directed is my favorite Pretty Cure movie.
How many Pretty Cure movies are there?
There's one for every series, so there's like 12 now, I think.
Yeah.
And then there's the All Star movies, which is all the Pretty Cures. So there's like, I think there's like 10 of those. So there's 22 Pretty Cure movies, I think.
Have you seen 22 Pretty Cure movies?
Oh God, no.
Okay. Just curious.
Come on, guys. It's called Glitter Force. Okay.
This is a good question. If people like Kyosugiga from Andy Pfeiffer, people like Kyosugiga, what other anime would you recommend that deal with family in a similar way? Well, The Eccentric Family.
Right.
Mm.
Specifically family.
Mm-hmm. Like family stuff? I would say His and Her Circumstances.
You think so?
I think so.
I don't remember it well enough to say.
I don't remember His and Her Circumstances well enough to say.
Yeah.
A little show called Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Oh, gosh.
No. You might not have heard of it, but it's pretty good.
Actually, if someone wants to think about bad anime dads, there's always Baki the Grappler.
Oh, jeez.
Everyone remembers
that. Don't recommend
that.
Baki the Grappler.
Run out and play Baki the Grappler, everybody. Mm-hmm. Says Dylan.
Yeah.
Kielman.
I mean, like, Kyosugiga is so unique that it's hard to compare it to... it really is unique. It's hard for me to compare.
Angel Dust 337 asks, what's the big thing you think Matsumoto matured or changed in her style and writing in Blood Blockade compared to Kyosugiga?
Not overloading with ideas. Like, so...
It was an adaptation, though. Can you really credit her with that?
I can, because the original stuff that she came up with is very simple, and it's, like, the whole... So, you know how the climax of Kyosugiga is two episodes... Like, the real climax, not all the fake ones, is two episodes long, and it goes, like, to a bunch of different planes, and it's just emotional moment after emotional moment, and it's dealing with, like, 20 different characters and their motivations, you know, kind of, like... But they sideline a lot of those, so they give, like, each person one conversation. So, anyway... Blood Blockade is just kind of about two siblings. At the end, is about two siblings, and the protagonist's involvement in their struggle is not really that deep seated. It's just he has his own issue, and so it's much simpler. And so that whole ending is just people talking to Leonardo about his issue, so that he can get there, and then he can resolve the issue between these two siblings. And it's just simple and beautiful, and it's not like there aren't too many ideas. The cosmic layer that it adds is Jesus versus Satan, which is, you know, pretty straightforward. And if you don't know that it's Jesus versus Satan because they never use those words, it just works as an action set piece. But yeah, Blood Blockade is weirdly more... It's weird to say that it's more cohesive because it was more of an episodic show, but it is... more cohesive in terms of you don't have to make everything important. The side roads are the side roads. Kyosugiga, the side roads feel like they're tied into the main story, and so they feel superfluous. Basically, there's a need to combine everything into the core, and not all of it combines, and so it feels superfluous. Whereas Blood Blockade is like, obviously this isn't important, this is an adventure episode, and the stuff that's important, you know. So I guess just the same thing that every creator who gets more experience does, which is learning not to put all of their ideas in at once, like, which is, I think, kind of a universal thing for really ambitious, talented people, is like their earlier efforts are too many things, and then they pare back as they work on stuff, and they're like, okay, well, I know I can save this for later, and this isn't relevant, and, you know, they get better at killing their darlings, I think.
Okay. All right, I guess that about wraps us up. Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Brady and Dylan for stopping by. Appreciate it, you guys. The theme song is called Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, here on YouTube. We'd really appreciate it. Thank you all for coming by.
Yes.
We'll see y'all next week. No, wait, we'll be in Japan next week. There will be a podcast next week from Japan, so keep an eye out for that. We may not do it on YouTube. We might do it on... We'll see. We'll see. So, yeah. Take it easy, guys. Have a good one.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.